Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. The Kahoolawe Island Reserve Commission is running out of money to continue its work, and the once brisk solar industry is hanging on HECO's moratorium. From restoration of an island to the plans of the solar industry, today we'll continue our look at the legislative packages of caucuses, organizations, and industries.
I'm Chris Vandercook, and Israel is frequently in the headlines, but fewer are the accounts of day-to-day life. A new book shows life inside Israel, and we'll talk with its author. We'll also explore the latest in the world of Maui improv. It looks a lot like life.
We'll talk about all of that today on The Conversation for Tuesday, January 13th from HPR2. Coming up next, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning. I felt like I was almost in the soundtrack of a movie.
Yeah, I was trying sort of a 60s French movie, you know, Umbrellas of Cherbourg kind of thing.
Precisely. But we're not going to talk about that this morning.
Not right now.
No, not right now. But we are going to talk about some of the issues that we will be talking about as we move into the legislative session starting next week. Now, this one we've had conversations about for years. It's a matter that the Kahoolawe Island Reserve Commission is running out of money. The once flush fund from the federal government to restore the island after its military use is down to its last year and its last million. Since it was granted in 1993, the $44 million trust has helped to rehab the island from the site of a bombing practice to cultural and educational activities. But without a $3 million appropriation from the legislature this coming session, all of that could be in jeopardy. Michael Nahoopi'i is the executive director of the Kahoolawe Island Reserve Commission, and he joins us again this morning. Good morning.
Welcome Good morning, Beth Ann, and thank you very much for having me here today.
Good to talk to you again. It seems in some ways we're having the same conversation we've been having for a long time, only now it's in a little bit more dire situation because you're down to the last $1 million and the last year of this federal funding.
It's a make or break year for us. We've been coming to the legislature for the last 5 or 6 years telling the same story that the funding, even though it was significant back in 1993 when we started. And for the last 20+ years, it has been our only source of funding. And, you know, it's very important for us that we knew a long time ago that the fund will never be permanent for the whole life of the island. We knew that we had to do something to share the burden that we've taken on. And we want to make sure that we remind people that this is still a very relevant place for the people of Hawaii. And it should be important not just to the people who go there, but for everyone in the state of Hawaii.
And that importance is going to be judged along with many other issues that are deemed important, too. But this one, it comes out life a little differently and has a different significance in a much broader scope, perhaps. But your point that we knew that this was going to run out eventually, that it was never meant to be the be-all, end-all to restore the island, seemed to somehow to be lost over these last 20 years.
It seemed like it was difficult to ask for money over the years as we still had a balance left in our trust fund. And so, you know, there are a lot of issues that the legislature has to deal with every year. And as long as we still had some money left over, it seemed to be pushed back to the next year. Let's deal with you next year. Let's deal with you next year. But this is the last year. And if we are not successful this year, we are contemplating closing down access to the island, securing what we're doing, you know, this dream that was started back in from 1976, the landing on the island, to the movement to get Kahoolawe back to the people of Hawaii will probably die after all these years.
With the case that you've just made, both in what you've been told after all these years, you know, come back to us when the money is pretty short. Well, you're at that point now. So really, this year is truly whether the legislature will be making good by its if not promised you, but its sort of implicated promise.
Yes, and we're hoping, we have worked with a lot of the legislators, we worked with a lot of the people in the administration, and I think a lot of people understand in their mind and in their heart, Kahoʻolawe is very important. And we're hoping that people can understand that it is as important as other issues in Hawaii. It shouldn't be placed on the back burner. You know, we're just as important as affordable housing, as education, as other issues that deal with not only just Native Hawaiians, because we are not just a Native Hawaiian issue, but we are an issue for all the people of the state of Hawaii.
And its history.
And its history. It was significant to see the people of Hawaii rally together to ask for something to be returned or more demanded. And we are one of the few places in Hawaii that has been returned from federal use back to the state. And it was a commitment by the state of Hawaii to say, we can do something. We want to take it back. We want to be responsible for managing it. For those years, our organization has been the one that has been carrying the burden, carrying the effort for the people. And we want to just see if we can get a little help this year.
Have you talked at all with the new administration? Have you had any sort of dialogue with the governor's office?
Some limited. We just met with the, as part of our, we are part of the Department of Land and Natural Resources. And we did meet with the governor's staff to request funding to be inserted into the administration's bill. And we have been going through the legislature and talking to key individuals in both the House and the Senate to provide support or some other options in the future, or this year especially. But we want to hope that everyone will get together and finally realize that it is a very key and important thing that we're doing.
The money that you're looking for is to help with infrastructure, usually not something that a grant will support or specific funds may support. But you really have to have that infrastructure to be able to continue the work that you're doing, because you're talking about being able to maintain offices, being able to pay some salaries, being able to bring people to the island. All that's going to take money.
That's one of the unique things about our organization. Not only do we manage the island from a commission and policy standpoint, but we are physically managing the island. We make the water, generate electricity, provide the boat transportation, and a lot of it is done with the staff of the Kahoʻolawe Island Reserve Commission. We are very dedicated and also a very highly trained, but experienced group that is able to do a lot of these things with a very small group of people. And one of the fears is that if we lose our staff or we lose any of the capabilities we have, it will be very difficult for someone else to recreate this and to start it back up again. So it's also important that we have continuity through these years so that we don't lose the capabilities to manage this island. Even if they think that they're going to try to maybe put it on hold for a while and then bring it back, it will be very difficult to find the people who have the experience of working on a very remote place, dealing with unexploded ordnance, because the Navy did not complete all the cleanup on the island, dealing with the unique characterization of the island of providing the infrastructure and taking care of people out there too.
You're making the point that backpedaling takes a lot more effort.
Yes, and that's why, you know, the federal government understands the need to keep certain key infrastructure open, such as shipyards and other elements, through lean years, just so that they can retain the capabilities of when they do have money again. So that's another discussion that we're trying to have is, you know, keep us going, provide bridge funding to when time gets better and money gets better, but don't secure the island and think that the island can be reopened again in a few years. Our best understanding and what we've seen through history is that once you lose a very specific capabilities, it's very hard to bring it back.
At this point where you've made the case over and over again, and you just did once again, albeit in a year where you're about to lose whatever funding you've got left from the federal government, do you have any sense that this is falling on more open ears than it has in past from the conversations that you've had with lawmakers? Do they seem to understand that really this is, as we talked about in the beginning of this conversation, a make or break year?
I think the one thing that I've seen this year that makes it different is when we visit them this year, when we walk into the office, they have our annual reports sitting on their desk and they have read it. I've gotten calls this year about the stories that we've been telling about that this is the year. And that is a significant difference from the past years. We've have to go out and engage. People are coming to us and saying, what can we do to help? And we're very hopeful about that.
Well, we wish you all the best, and we'll be following what happens this year because you got awfully close last year.
Thank you very much.
Michael Naho'opi'i is the Executive Director of the Kahoolawe Island Reserve Commission. He's been involved with Kahoolawe from virtually every perspective in its recent history, and a longtime Protect Kahoolawe Ohana member and former U.S. Navy officer in charge of Kahoolawe during its conveyance of the island to the state of Hawaii. He was also a senior manager during the early model cleanup and later the Navy Unexploded Ordnance Cleanup Project. You're listening to The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:15. Later in the show, actually coming up in just a bit, looking at Israel through the lives and the leisure of those who live there. But first, your backyard quiz.
Umurokai, Ulanai, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavaiti.
Psychobilly is a genre of music that fuses elements of punk rock, rockabilly, surf rock, and swing. While Hawaii isn't exactly a breeding ground for psychobilly bands, there have been several artists, such as the Hell Caminos, that add some local flavor to the genre. Consisting of Michael Camino on upright bass, Nick Danger on guitar, and Handsome Jack on the stand-up drums, the Hell Caminos have produced two albums, 2005's Through the Day and Through the Night, and their 2008 follow-up, Lust. Recently, the Hell Caminos celebrated their 10th year anniversary as a band with two shows on Oahu, one on Maui. Though they do perform on occasion, the Hell Caminos are technically on hiatus due to the fact that their upright bass player, Michael Camino, spends most of the year touring with a London-based folk band. For today's Backyard Quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us which London-based artist Michael Camino now plays bass for. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, or keep your ears out for it in the next half of the show.
Support for today's programming comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting Becky's New Car, a comedy that explores love and loss and asks, what makes life worth living? Opening this Thursday. ManoaValleyTheater.com.
What is day-to-day life like in Israel, far from the stories that make the headlines? Few of us in America think of it as a place where people work and play, and where, for most people, life goes on as it would in any other country. It's a perspective that's best understood from within through the viewpoint of its citizens. And more than 50 of those voices are heard in Israeli Life and Leisure in the 21st Century, which was edited by Michael Leitner and his wife, Sarah. And Michael is with us this morning. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here today.
You know, I think I'm probably like a lot of people in having my initial reaction be leisure, right? who thinks of that as happening in this, you know, nation that is in a fairly constant state of struggle?
Right. Leisure is an important aspect of it's the most important aspect of life in terms of determining quality of life. Leisure is defined as simply free time.
Yeah.
The time in which you can choose to do what you want to do. And the activities that Israelis do in their leisure really is a reflection of their life, of the culture, of the society. And so it's very important to understand it to really get an accurate picture of what Israel today is.
You've seen a lot of particularly sports activity mm-hmm. as a leisure activity and how it creates bonds among the people who take part in it, right?
That's right. One section of the book, and the book has 55 chapters, one section of the book is devoted to different chapters on different recreational programs that bring together Arabs and Jews, Palestinians and Israelis in a positive way to improve attitudes. We have chapters on ice hockey for peace, ultimate frisbee for peace, soccer for peace, and other programs, taking an in-depth view of how are these programs conducted, how do they work, what effects are they having on attitudes. And it can't help but give you some optimism, a positive outlook for the prospects, the possibilities of peace, even in these times when just so recently there was a conflict.
In team sports, you have to rely on the people you're stuck with on your team,
right,
no matter who they are.
Right.
And that inevitably changes the way you look at them, right?
Exactly. As I was involved this summer in a program called the Friendship Games. It was a basketball tournament for 1 week with athletes from different countries, from Jordan, from Palestinians, from Israelis. And I spoke with one Palestinian young man. He said he used to hate Jews. He hated Jews, but one day he had to play on a team with a Jew who he particularly hated. But they had to pass the ball to each other in order to win the game.
Yeah.
And then he started to like him a little more, and then they started playing more together. Now they're best friends. They visit each other's homes and celebrate holidays together. And these are the kinds of changes that can occur through sports and other recreational programs.
And, you know, I bet when he was in that state of mind where he said he hated Jews, he might not have known exactly why.
Exactly. And now, to the importance of the book, you know, there are people who have never been to Israel, never been there, really know very little about it, but perhaps even in a faraway, peaceful place like Hawaii, for some reason, decide that they hate Israel, maybe because of things they've read in the media and so forth. The book is attempting to really open the eyes of the public. It's intended for the general public as well as a book that will be used at universities, but for the general public to really understand, what is Israel? What is this country? It's not just a country that fights wars and defends itself. It's a country that has a unique communal living arrangement that exists nowhere else in the world called the kibbutz. It's a country that is choreographing new folk dances every day. It's a country that has tennis centers located throughout the country. It's a country that has fantastic beaches, a country that has more museums per capita than anywhere in the world, a country that, despite all its challenges, has citizens that are among the happiest in the world. And how can they be among the happiest in the world when they face economic challenges, security challenges? And the book reveals this, as well as the incredible diversity of the population. There are chapters about the older population in Israel, many of whom don't speak the language of Hebrew, about the Arab minority in Israel, about the ultra-Orthodox Jewish minority in Israel, and many different aspects of the society.
You wonder sometimes, I wonder about the life of nations as being like the life of people, where you have certain attitudes when you're young, certain attitudes when you're middle-aged. You know, we've seen in the past nations that became great but grew old, declined, you know, the Roman Empire. And I wonder if America, 200-plus years on, hasn't maybe lost some of that new nation esprit de corps, because I think you see that in Israel, don't you?
Absolutely. It's a country that's building. It's changing all the time. The character, It's amazing what it's accomplished since its creation in 1948. It's
which is just nothing in historical time, right?
It's nothing, despite all the challenges that it's been facing and, you know, security concerns. Yes, absolutely.
The stereotype of the warrior nation, it's not just the warrior nation, it's the warrior desert nation.
Right.
One of the things I saw in your book was that something like one-third of its land is parkland, our national park, our recreational land, you know, for people's use.
Absolutely. One-third, yes, of the country is devoted to that, even though it's a very densely populated country. Yes.
There's an emphasis on open space.
An emphasis on open space, on quality of life, on family. There are some similarities between Israel and Hawaii, which you wouldn't think, you know, well, those two. But they're very similar in terms of the beaches, the emphasis on family, family closeness, strong culture, music, and sense of togetherness.
Are you optimistic for Israel?
I'm very optimistic for Israel. There is so much positive energy. I work with fantastic people. Just the book, putting this book together, we didn't know at first, well, how could we write such a book? You know, how many people would be interested in contributing? And the response we got was overwhelming. You know, we have over 50 authors, each having expertise in the areas that they wrote about, who contributed and devoted their time and energy to this. I mean, this is a unique book because we have so many experts in different areas who have contributed to it. If I may just quote Shimon Peres, who was a former Nobel Peace Prize winner and former president of Israel, who said that this book is notable in its scope and reach and is an impressive work that takes one on a journey across the country, across society, and across different ages and interests. And it really is unique in that way, that it is so in-depth and so broad and can give the reader a real understanding of what this country is today.
So a journey well worth taking, Michael. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Michael Leitner and his wife Sarah are the editors of Israeli Life and Leisure in the 21st Century, just released by Sagamore Publishing. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hashtag gotcha 4 stars. The generals at U.S. Central Command get sonied and have their social media accounts hacked. Online threats to harm U.S. military personnel strike closer to home. Who's behind this hack? Pyongyang, pranksters, or ISIS? A look at the short list of suspects next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Ciao. I'm Ben Soda from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue this conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
The case involving ORI Anuenue Hale may have fallen far from your mind, but other Oahu nonprofits say they should have their loans forgiven too. And some of the organizations claim they've been waiting for 3 years for Honolulu officials to respond to their request. Civil Beat editor Patty Epler joins us today with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Without taking a lot of time to go back to the whole case with ORI and Anoinwehale. The whole point is that the city did forgive $1.2 million in loans that it had given to ORI. And other nonprofits are saying, well, okay, if you did it for them, how about for us, since we're providing a lot of those same services? And from what I gather, the city hasn't been responding to them for all this time, almost 3 years.
That's exactly right, Beth Ann. So HUD, the Federal Housing Agency, is concerned that the city is not treating everyone fairly. And in fact, they describe the ORI loan forgiveness as a total flip-flop from the policy. So they want to make sure everyone is being treated fairly. So there's been four nonprofits that have asked the city to look at forgiving their loans, because they're also, like mental health service, homeless service providers, that kind of thing. And they just can't get the city to respond to them. And the other thing is HUD can't get the city to respond to it either about this.
That part especially doesn't bode well. I mean, we've had other situations where people have been very persistent and had to have a great deal of tenacity to get an answer back from the city. But the fact that HUD can't get those answers back either, that puts everyone in a very compromised position, especially those nonprofits.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and, as you might not be surprised to hear, we couldn't get the city to talk to us about it either. But if you read the story that Sophie Koch wrote for us on our website, there's some detailed anecdotes about what some of these nonprofits have gone through to try to get the city to talk to them about what's going on. And then HUD sort of stepped in on their behalf as well. And I guess to me that's probably the most disturbing thing, is that the city does seem like it's trying to dodge everyone on this issue, and it's unknown why, really.
Do they have any sort of recourse beyond just all of us talking about it sort of in the public sphere? Is there anything that they've told you that they intend to do next, both alone and also with HUD?
The nonprofits are basically just waiting to see what happens. They're sort of treating these loans as grants in a way, so I think that they're not actually repaying the loans as they might be, if it were an actual loan. So I think they're just waiting to see when it all comes due what they're going to have to do about it.
But isn't it with the Community Development Block Grant that they can either give them as grants, out and out, or give them as loans?
Yes, that's true. But these four in particular that total about $9 million were given as a loan, and there is repayment expected at some point, which is what these nonprofits are trying to figure out.
And so that they can be hopefully receiving the same treatment as was given to ORI, Anoinwehale, under some would say very questionable circumstances.
Exactly.
All right. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Patty Epler is the editor of CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local, national, and international news programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
Not that long ago, Hawaii's booming solar industry saw a very bright future with seemingly no end in sight for its growth. But a moratorium on solar hookup to HECO brought the industry's downturn into sharp focus. Over the last 18 months, thousands of customers have been waiting for permission to connect their solar power systems. Only a handful have been recently granted. And in fairness, that's as we're waiting for some necessary studies to be released. As Hawaii's legislative session is set to start, the executive director of the Hawaii Solar Industry Association has appointed to-do list. And Leslie Cole Brooks joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Great to see you again.
Good to talk to you, too. Now, when last we talked, the big concern was the fact that there was this moratorium. People were being left in limbo, waiting to see what could happen and could they possibly connect. We've only had a handful of people who have been allowed to do so very recently, but there are reasons for that. So without beating HECO unduly over the head, we are waiting for some studies that are due in the next couple of weeks, right?
Right, that's right. So we're expecting a study to come out, the final version, here at the end of January, beginning of February. And it's looking at something called transient overvoltage, which is basically what happens if someone hits a power pole and the line breaks, and how quickly can an inverter turn off. So that's been a concern. The results preliminary are very positive, and we're hoping that when those are released soon, that those customers that are in the queue right now on the more saturated circuits will be able to be released. But there's a lot of customers in that queue, and it's a lot to be done to follow through on the promise that the utility made.
We're talking thousands.
Thousands, mm-hmm. Thousands of customers. And, you know, time goes so quickly. It's already, nearly the middle of January. Their commitment was to have the queue cleared, with the exception of just a couple of hundred, by April of this year. So I hope they have the resources and the staff in the NEM department to take care of those applications.
Last time we talked, there was also the issue of having smart inverters and what that would mean, so that as power is fed into the system, it would be done so safely. What kind of resolution have you seen happen with that, or growth in that discussion since we last talked?
Well, you know, inverters are smart already. I mean, there already are standards that have been in place for years and years that react to the grid and know what to do when and all that kind of thing. But because of the way distributed generation has grown, the utility has looked at new standards because of just how things are designed here. And, you know, that's been a frustrating process, I have to say. Since last year, June 9th, we had AES drop out like it did yesterday, right? And that was an emergency situation. But it's taken a very long time to get those new standards in place. And we're still waiting for the final results on that. And now every system that goes in, the customer has to commit to changing out those systems to the new standards. And it's created a lot of uncertainty for industry, too, because they're waiting to find out, well, what do they need so they can go through the testing and certification process.
And what's that standard going to be?
Right. So that's been very frustrating for us. We've been working closely with the industry or with the utility and the industry as a liaison to help them with what makes sense, what can be done, and let's just get it done. But it takes a long time. And
so the prognosis for that is still, we're going to have to wait and see?
Well, it's getting closer. I believe that they've made a commitment by September of 2015 that it will all be cleared up. But once they arrive at these new ride-through settings, the inverter manufacturers need to go and do testing and certification to ensure that their particular device can do that safely. So that takes time, too. Meanwhile, as you're installing a new system, you have to commit to going back and changing that out once it's been determined. So
all of this means that customers who are still in the queue, or perhaps even thinking that they want to go and purchase a solar system, are going to be just hanging.
That's kind of the posture right now. Yes, I mean customers are actually getting to install, just nothing like it was before, and there just is a lot of uncertainty now. It's a very painful transition, but I still I totally believe in distributed generation. It's such an important part of the puzzle here in Hawaii. We're going to get through this. We're going to get grid upgrades done so that we can have a modern system and take advantage of all these people and systems that want to get along. So
what does all of this mean for potential new customers who have been thinking about this for a while, waiting to see what was going to happen, see whether that what they wanted to have happen could actually be something that would happen in reality? I mean, they feel like they're sort of, we're all in this wait-and-see mode.
Yes, we are. For customers that are in the queue as of October 22nd of 2014, there is uncertainty there as well in terms of how the utility is going to treat those new applications. Will we need to wait for the commission to respond to the utility's plan? Are some going forward? It's really unclear. And then on top of that, we also have a docket that's looking at non-export systems, which is another way that a customer could potentially install photovoltaics, have battery backup. You know, it's more expensive, but it'd be a way that we could still keep the momentum and trying to do everything we can to reduce our dependence upon fossil fuels, help the environment. That's also in process right now. And we actually had, a bit of a breakthrough this last week with that docket. So it's getting closer, and that's a very important stepping stone because we see storage is so key with the big picture here because of the joke that got played on Hawaii, right? You know, that God played the little joke that we have sun, wind, wave, biomass, geothermal, and our peak load is at night. And so the load and the generation doesn't always match. But with storage, that problem can be solved.
What are you making of the resignation of Hermina Morita? Does that play into this at all?
Oh, it absolutely does. I just got the news this morning, actually. And it's a bittersweet thing because she's been involved in energy for a very long time. There are several very complicated and key dockets at the PUC right now. And she has, you know, she's in the midst of all that. And so to lose her chair now is... I feel a little sad, and I'm sorry to see her go. And at the same time, I really am excited about embracing change because I think we've been in a limbo there, too, because our commissioner, since before the election, has been at will. So was she going to be reappointed? What was going to happen? So now Governor Ige needs to act and appoint a new commissioner. And I'm hoping that will just invigorate the commission. I'm hoping that the commission is going to get all the resources they need. They can lock arms and they can get through this because they have the decoupling dockets, the PSIP, the distributed generation. And then, of course, we have the issue with NextEra and the merger. And it's just nuts, actually.
And if it's nuts for you on your end, as you're saying, in the minds of an average customer, this is something that is just swirling around them to where they're running the other way, which doesn't do much for your industry.
Well, you know, I have this T-shirt that says it's an English saying, right? This is keep calm and carry on. I've been wearing that.
I think a lot of us have that T-shirt.
Okay, but that's where it came from. I wear it more and more, and I think that's just the thing. Keep calm, carry on. Renewable generation is the right thing to do, large and small. We've got a lot of roof space out there. People want to invest. We're going to get there, but it's tough. So,
well, good luck as you come into the beginning of next session next week.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll see how things go.
Okay.
Thanks so much for coming in with an update. Leslie Cole Brooks is the executive director of the Hawaii Solar Energy Association, a nonprofit trade organization. She trained as a geologist, later became an attorney, and is a member of the California and Hawaii State Bar Associations.
Hi, good morning. I'm Jessica Leboeuf from Cirque du Soleil Kidam. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
And this morning in the Backyard Quiz, we talked a little bit about that musical genre you just heard, psychobilly. It's a style that's often described as an amalgamation of punk rock, rockabilly, surf rock, and sometimes even swing. While Hawaii isn't exactly a central hub for psychobilly bands, there have been several artists who, over the years, have called our islands home, including the band The Hell Caminos. The group has produced two albums, one in 2005, the other in 2008. Last month, the band celebrated its 10-year anniversary with two shows on Oahu and one on Maui. Though they performed recently, the Hell Caminos are technically always on hiatus, and that's due to the fact that their upright bass player, Michael Camino, spends most of the year touring with a London-based folk band. And for today's Backyard Quiz, we were wondering if you could tell us which London-based artist Michael Camino now plays bass. And that would be Skinny Lister.
And Beth Ann Linney Morris from Oahu. knew the answer. Congratulations. It is 8:47, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm songwriter Tim Rose, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Improv has grown to become kind of a verbal cousin to jazz, depending as it does on quick thinking and the capacity to create in the moment. Audiences and performers have something in common. Neither knows what's coming next. Chris Rose is a member of Maui Improv, which will present a show called Improvocation at next week's Maui Fringe Festival, and he joins us by phone from Maui. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Chris.
It's always seemed to me, Chris, that the challenge in improv is keeping a flow going on stage, huh?
Yeah, it's almost like you want to speak before you think.
Yeah.
So, like a problem I had as a kid, I was always told to actually think before I speak, but I think now it's better to do the other way around.
Oh, yeah, it's thinking is way overrated, but most people don't. People really don't think before they speak. They just speak and the thoughts emerge, right?
Well, I think a lot of times there is a little voice in your head that's telling you, you know, act this way and be this way and, mm-hmm. and say this. And instead of being extremely present on stage or even in life, we constantly have that little voice telling us what to say and how to say it. And with improv, you're really trying to eliminate that voice and just come from a very present moment.
When you're on stage doing an improv performance and it's working, do you feel it kind of taken to a different place?
Oh, yeah. It's like electricity. And you just feel the heightening of everything. And you really feel the audience. The audience is such a major factor in it because they are also... they're discovering, like you said at the very beginning, as you discover. And that energy there, it really, really creates a beautiful feeling.
There's always that feeling before you get on stage, particularly when you're, and I'm thinking specifically of music, where if a lot of what you do is improvisation, there's a lot you have to sort of trust. And you can get sort of just that moment just before you get on stage, you almost have to make your mind a blank, in a sense. It can be sort of an uneasy feeling, can't it?
Well, I love it to the sense that I don't have to remember any lines.
True.
I don't have to remember anything that's going to happen. And it is complete trust in your partners. And that's what, you know, before I go on stage, there's that little mantra of they all love me and I trust them completely. And it's a real freeing feeling.
How do you get to that place of trust in your partners?
I think a lot of it is being with them. It's weird to think that improv does rehearsals, but, you know, we do practice the exercise, the pieces we're going to do. And the more you're with somebody, I mean, even in a relationship, the more you're with somebody, the more you understand them. And if it's a positive relationship, the more you trust them. And so I think it's the time spent with each other that really, really creates that bond.
I think the first time I talked to somebody about improv, I was introduced to the idea, and I'm not sure if I'm getting it right, but that whole idea of responding with yes and rather than no but.
Right. You're keeping a very positive situation. And that's what the beauty of improv is, if you stay in that yes and place, no matter what the other person says, something beautiful is going to happen. Even if they had misunderstood what you said and giving you something completely off the wall, if you yes and it, it can be something incredibly rich and textured and fun.
Where you surprise yourself, you surprise your partner, you surprise everybody.
Oh, definitely. And that is the beauty of it. Yeah, it's like Christmas.
But if you can also, in an improv situation, you can almost inadvertently block an idea if you don't follow that mantra, yeah?
Right. It is. It's all about really listening. I mean, we listen with our eyes as well. So when you're looking at your partner on stage and they're giving the next line, you truly listening to what they're saying instead of having, you know, your idea of plot or character in the back of your head telling you what you're going to say next. You want to be listening to what the other person is saying, because that line is the one that is going to inform you of what you're going to do next. So staying present with that keeps the flow.
And it might even dictate your character, as in you become a different person based on your response to what just got said to you, yeah?
Completely. So you know, listening is the most vital part of improv.
Your upcoming performance is called Improvocation.
Mm-hmm.
What's the provocation component of it?
It sounded really cool. and that was basically it.
An honest really answer. I wasn't ready for that. No, I like that. But at the same time, you do in a lot of improv kind of challenge the audience, go ask the audience for suggestions, right?
Yes, you do. I mean, the audience is a huge factor in the performance. We have a piece in it that we call Life Sentences, where we have audience members write down a sentence that they've used in the day of their life. You know, when we put those sentences in a hat and we start each scene with that sentence. And so the audience, you know, the audience is helping us create what, you know, the magic that is happening.
So you pull up a sentence out of a hat saying, I woke up in a room and I had no idea where I was, right? And that.
Yeah. And the other person on stage begins the scene with you.
It really calls for some, I think a lot of people would find that very daunting. It calls for a pretty high degree of alertness. But you guys are used to it, I guess, huh, Chris?
Well, we have fun with it.
Well, I think that's the key.
I mean, it's a real enjoyable thing to do. It's art that is created spontaneously out of the air and will never happen again. That piece, that moment is gone, and there's some beauty to that.
Oh, I'm sure there is. Thanks very much, Chris.
You're welcome. Have a good night.
You too.
Hey, bye. Chris.
Chris bye. Rose and the other members of Maui Improv will perform Improvocation at the Maui Fringe Theater Festival, which runs January 23rd through 25th at the historic Iao Theater. And you can find out more at hpr2.org.
Thank you. On New Letters on the Air, poet Valjina Mort talks about how growing up in Belarus inspired imagery of movement, migration, and the exiled body.
Eastern Europe is a territory where people had to move not because they chose to, but because they were forced.
Listen to Valjina Mort, who reads from her book, Collected Body, next time on New Letters on the Air.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
But then, news media are often accused, and somewhat accurately, of focusing only on the sensational. And you could probably say that about our perception of Israel. So it was interesting to talk with Michael Leitner about his view of life, his and the view of many others, of life inside that country, where people have leisure time, lead everyday lives.
The reality of it is that unless you're really there and you know, you have to rely on reports from other people, and that's just kind of that's how it goes. But to talk to people who actually do have lives, manage to live lives that include things like daily activities and leisure, and to hear what he had to say was a little illuminating.
It'd be good if we could apply that to many other parts of the world as well. Could use it, I'm sure.
Or just do what people had to do a long time ago and travel when you can.
There you go.
But that requires some other things, too. We'll talk about that another time. But for today, that's going to do it for us. Up tomorrow, we're going to pick up the conversation about how implicit bias can affect legal proceedings. We're going to talk with Professor Robert Smith from the University of North Carolina Law School, who is here visiting.
And launching a conservation project with a 750-mile run and bike tour of the islands.
You can post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. Or if you like email, we've got that too. It's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Past shows are at hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.